Hello, I'm Grant Gordon.
And I'm Ravi Gurumurthy, and this is Displaced, a podcast about the global refugee crisis. And it's a partnership between Vox Media and the International Rescue Committee, where Grant and I work.
We launched this podcast this spring, and the end of our first season is fast approaching. We are coming to an end at the end of October, but fear not, we will be back in January with fresh episodes. And in the meantime, we'd love to keep hearing from you. Email us at displaced@rescue.org or tweet at us. I'm at Grant M. Gordon, and Ravi's
at R. Gurumurthy.
With any ideas, feedback for the new season, people you'd like to hear, snacks that are your favorite, flavors of dumplings that you love, we'd love to hear from you.
And if you like listening to Displaced, you can help us grow the show in a couple of ways. You can subscribe
on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to us now.
Or you can rate and review the show. And lastly, you can tell someone you know about the show and get them to listen to it as well.
Thank you so much for your support of Displaced. And on today's show is David Miliband, who is not only the previous foreign minister of the UK, he's not only the CEO and president of the IRC, he's our boss.
And for this episode, we decided to lock Grant away because we thought it'd be a bit career limiting for him to ask difficult questions of David Miliband.
I was out doing actual humanitarian work. You were just doing a podcast.
You were, to be fair. And it was in the evening because we actually recorded this at the New School. I managed to consume half a bottle of wine during the interview and fell ill actually the next day. But it was a good, really good, it was a really good interview. I thought it was fun. And take a listen. Welcome to this live recording of Displaced, the podcast that's brought to you with Vox Media and the International Rescue Committee. It's particularly great to be here at the New School. A big thanks to Alex Alenikoff here, who's welcoming us. Alex was one of my first guests on Displaced, and I made the fatal mistake of referring to him as old. So, Alex, I'm really, really sorry for that insult. I know your wife was not impressed. But I have to say, it's had brilliant feedback as one of the best podcasts that we've done. And Alex, like me, is now saving the world one podcast at a time with his new podcast called Tempest Tossed, which is great. Really do check that out as well. So I'm delighted today to be able to talk to my boss, David Miliband, who is the president and chief executive of the International Rescue Committee. And before that, spent many, many years in British politics. I worked with him from 2005 to 2010 when he was the Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs. He was also the Environment Secretary that brought in legislation to bind the UK to carbon emission limits. David has been in politics for many years. He was also the number 10 policy unit chief under Tony Blair. He was actually known affectionately there as Brains, after the Thunderbirds character, which was a really prophetic moment because if anyone is a fan of the Thunderbirds film, it actually refers to International Rescue. So Brains was a great prophetic nickname, both for his intellect and his future career. Now, when David and I talk normally, we talk really about two things. We talk about politics and we talk about football. And in fact, probably one of my favourite moments with David was we were in a very dreary meeting. He was in Davos and he texted me going, I think I'm going to have to saw off my own arm. This is so boring. So I texted him back going, what's your all-time Arsenal football 11? And quick as a flash, it came back, Kenny Sansom, all these different players. And we started debating who should be in central midfield. And I'm going to try and not talk to you about football today. I'm going to talk to you about your other love, which is politics. And this is something that obviously people have to, David has to steer clear of in his day job normally because he's leading a humanitarian NGO. So this is just a conversation between you and me, David, the New School, all our followers on Displaced. And do, if you want to tweet this, tweet Displaced Podcast. But be candid, David. So let's start on familiar territory. You've been on a tour of divided, conflict-ridden countries in recent months. But I'm not going to talk to you about the United Kingdom just yet. I'm going to talk to you about where you were just before that, a week beforehand, which was Yemen. And Yemen is often referred to as the worst humanitarian disaster in the world today. And what I'd love you to do is one, just paint a picture of what is going on there right now, but also put yourself in the mind of what you would have been doing if you were foreign secretary. How do you find a way through this politically? Because that is the theme that I really want to thread through this conversation about politics of humanitarianism.
Well, thanks, Ravi. It's really good to be here at the New School. Yemen is a country of 28 million people, and I was there 10 days ago. And the abiding images I have is not of tragedy, really, but of crimes. Because while Yemen is a country that's notable for 83% of the population being in extreme poverty, 8 million people dependent on the World Food Programme to get food, the United Nations saying 3.5 million people are on the brink of starvation, it's easy to call that a tragedy or a disaster, but that somehow implies there's something natural about it. And the reason I think it's an indictment or a crime is that it's really a man-made disaster as a result of the war that has been plaguing that country for the last 3.5 years. Those of you who know Yemen's history well will know that it got independence in the early 1960s and has had a very troubled period since then. But the last 3.5 years have plumbed new depths, really, in the depth of despair. Essentially, what you've got going on is a coup in 2014 by the so-called Houthi rebel movement. They drove the government out of Sana'a, which is in the north of Yemen, and they took over about 70% of the country. The subsequent 3.5 years have been led or have been involved a Saudi-led coalition that includes the United States, the United Kingdom, France, trying to reestablish what it calls the legitimate government of Yemen. That their efforts are being led not by Western troops and not by Saudi troops either. The main fighters are coming from a range of different militias in the south of the country trying to drive their way up to the north. And what is clear is that this war is not just creating humanitarian suffering on an unprecedented scale, it's also not being won by either side. So essentially you've got stalemate. The battle lines are not really moving very far. The current focus is on the port city of Hodeidah, through which 70 to 80% of the commercial and humanitarian traffic goes into the country. And so if you're looking at this as a humanitarian, you immediately realize it's a political emergency, not just a humanitarian emergency. And that really takes me to your question. What would I be doing? I would be saying, one, that the only way, that the first priority is to stop the killing. And that's why I would be advocating for a ceasefire. Secondly, I think it's very important to understand that there's not just one conflict going on in Yemen. It's not just the Saudi-led coalition against the Houthis. There's actually 5 or 6 different theaters to this. There's a separatist movement that wants to recreate South Yemen, the group of Salafists. There's Al-Qaeda and of the Arabian Peninsula. So you've got a complex situation that demands urgency. And that's the reason for raising that. The third thing, obviously, is that you've got to find a way to put pressure on the main parties to the conflict. The Houthis are an indigenous rebel movement. They're sometimes described as the Hezbollah of Yemen, but that would suggest that they were the creation of the Iranian regime. They're supported by the Iranians, but they weren't created by the Iranians. They've been there for a very long time. It's quite hard to put pressure on them, but it is possible to put pressure on the Iranians because they obviously have interest in the Iranian nuclear deal and a range of other measures, and I think that European countries are actually in a good position to put pressure on the Iranians in respect of Yemen. Then on the other side, you've got the Saudi-led coalition where the American role is very important. One interesting point is that the only time the Trump administration have spoken up publicly against the war strategy, which was in December of 2017, it actually led to quite an immediate shift in the tactics that were being pursued by the Saudi-led coalition. And so the final part of the answer is to say to you, don't believe that nothing can be done there, neither that it's so complex that nothing can be done, nor that the actors to the conflict are completely insensitive to the pressure of outsiders. They may be insensitive to the pressure of their own population. Both sides are alleged by the UN to have committed war crimes, but that's not to say that they're not subject to influence from outside.
You mentioned the stalemate there, and that's a general trend in other war situations. And if you look at the data across the world over the last 20, 30 years, it's actually really interesting. The number of civil wars actually peaked back in 1992. There were 48 in 1992. It's actually fallen back now to around 30. And in most parts of the world, Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, the decline has been substantial. But the one region where that's not the case is the Middle East and North Africa. The trend goes in the exact opposite direction, from 3 in 2003 to 12 in 2014. I just wonder, what do you think the explanation is for that outlier, that region in particular, not keeping pace with the others and, in fact, bucking the trend decisively?
Well, first of all, I'd say two things. That figure of 30 that you've presented as a reduction in the number of civil wars, if you contrast that to the number of civil wars for the preceding 150 years, it's many multiples the size. So if you look at David Armitage's book called Civil Wars, he shows that the number of civil wars between 1816 and 1989 was about a tenth the level of the number of civil wars since 1990. So it's important not to lose that perspective that by historic standards, the number of civil wars that are going on at the moment is very high. And in a way, that's the simple explanation for why you've got so many refugees and displaced people. What was the question? Just remind me what the question was.
I was asking you, so why do you think it is the case?
Why is it happening in the Middle East? Yeah. So, with a lot of humility, I would point to the following things. First of all, since 1979, the tumult in the Islamic world, in significant parts of the Islamic world, has been a defining feature of Middle Eastern politics and is an important feature of the wars that are going on at the moment, whether in Afghanistan or whether in Syria. Although it's not a hot war, the dispute between Qatar and Saudi Arabia, those wars are fundamentally about, they're partly about theology, they're also about power, they're about engagement with the wider world. But they're also about intra-regional competition because of the Iranian influence. So I think you can't understand the situation in the Middle East without recognizing that this is a historic struggle for power going on within the Islamic world or parts of the Islamic world. Secondly, you've got states which have educated their populations but not given them any power. I mean, my reading of the Syrian story is that it was an educated country. In 2005, something called the Damascus Declaration was a declaration by 250 intellectuals who were demanding accountable government. And so part of the Syrian story is that a government had lost the confidence of its own people. In a way, it was a version of the Arab Spring story that happened in Egypt. So I think that's an important part of it. The third part of the story is that the outside powers, the US and the Russians, have certainly until recently not known how to play their cards there, and in some cases, notably in the Iraq War, played their cards very badly and helped create some of the tumult that you see today. But what you've got is, in global terms, educated societies where citizens lack power, where elites are feuding with each other, and where there is this overarching divide, which is theological and very, very deep in origin.
One of the ways in which I think we've got less conflict in sub-Saharan Africa and other parts of the world than historically was the case is that peacekeeping operations have actually been successful. Although peacekeepers get incredibly bad press and there are lots of scandals and problems, the basic prescription of trying to bring about a peace agreement, putting in place peacekeepers, and then gradually through that third-party intervention enabling peace to occur has been quite effective. Now, the question is, how do you do that in the Middle East when that's basically not possible, when the UN Security Council are never going to come to any kind of agreement? And to what extent do you think that with the UN Security Council log-jammed perpetually in the Middle East and North Africa, we're back into the situation before the Cold War, when essentially we didn't have a way of intervening and bringing conflict?
Yeah, I have a slightly different reading of it, though, because what I see is peacekeeping missions. I mean, you can think about DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, which are going across generations but lack any political strategy to create the institutions or the sharing of power that could allow those peacekeepers ever to leave. And so I think that the biggest challenge for UN peacekeeping is, how does it relate to local politics? Because if we've learned anything about civil wars, it's that if there isn't a sharing of local political power, then you're not going to be able to get any kind of long-term stability. And I'd like to see the data about this, because remember, if you think about what's happening in Nigeria at the moment, we have a lot of operations in northeast Nigeria, where you've got a terrorist movement, Boko Haram, which has upended the local power structure. But in the middle of the country, you've got huge division and feuding over land rights. And in the south of the country, there's the unfinished business of the argument about oil production and who controls it. And there's no peacekeepers there. So I wouldn't go with the argument that the story of Africa is a story, or the story of sub-Saharan Africa it can be told simply through peacekeeping. I mean, if you think about somewhere like South Sudan, the war's raging, 1.5 million refugees, and the peacekeepers, when they've been trying to do their jobs, I mean, in that circumstance, you've got people hiding in UN protection of civilian sites. And the peacekeeping story is one that has been heroic in some ways, has been abuse on the other hand. But I think the bigger part of the story is, where's the politics?
I think the underlying issue is that when wars come to an end, they either come to an end because of all-out victory, or because the parties somehow come together through a power-sharing negotiated agreement. And when you try and get power-sharing, it has to rely on those parties trusting that one of them will not renege. In particular, if you're the dominant party, you're not going to give in and allow another party to come into your government, because they then may launch a coup. Unless you think there's a third party able to enforce that peace settlement.
Yeah, or unless you think there isn't a singular solution, unless you think that actually the story is of many decentralized struggles and there isn't a single deal to be done. Sometimes there are elite bargains, but often, and I know this more from Afghanistan, there's not a single deal to be done. And so I think...
A balance of power in lots of localities, basically.
Yeah, people say about Afghanistan, it's a country of 40,000 valleys and villages and valleys. And I think that understanding that is a really important rejoinder to the sense that there's always a Dayton-style peace agreement between two hierarchical controlling parties. You've often got a much more messy situation in which the distribution of federal power into localities is a really important part of it. Now, you can then still have the abuse of power locally, but it doesn't become the kind of regional disruptor that so many of these civil wars are.
I want to turn to...
Remember, look, you've got Somalia, the consequences of Somalia civil war still raging. The consequences of DRC still raging. The consequences of South Sudan still raging. Sierra Leone and Liberia overcoming the history of civil wars. So I think it's you know, fingers crossed that Zimbabwe doesn't fall back. Fingers crossed that Kenya continues to make progress. But I think the story I see is of parts of Africa rising and parts of Africa falling, and sometimes that's happening within the same country.
I want to turn to humanitarian aid and your vision for it now. One way of characterizing a vision for aid, particularly in the long term, is that when a person is displaced, they get cash immediately. Secondly, they get access to digital services like matching with jobs or information on where to use their cash or education. The third element could be that they get the right to work and the right to go into public education. And I want to sort of dwell on that third element, rights to work and rights to learn. That's something you've pushed quite hard in your work. You wrote a lot about it in your book. Where in the world right now can we look to for inspiration on giving people rights to work?
Well, I mean, people are surprised when I say this, but Uganda is the model for a country that's been willing to extend rights to work, rights to services, rights to movement. It's understood. I talk about refugee camps being funeral homes for dreams. And what I think Uganda has recognized, that you can set up camps temporarily, but they end up becoming permanent. And so the story that comes to my mind whenever I'm asked, we are giving out business loans to women in Kampala, the capital of Uganda. These are South Sudanese refugees. And the woman who comes to my mind has a banana ripening business where she rented a little shack on the basis of the money that we gave her. She then ripened the bananas. She sold them. She bought for a dollar, she sold for $1.50. She used the profit to be able to pay off the loan, but also to help her daughter get through university. She introduces me to her, through school, she introduces me to her daughter, who says she's studying public health at Kampala University. And when I ask her, what do you want to do with your life when you finish? She says, I want to go back to South Sudan to work on the health system in South Sudan. And so that's at a very individual level. But we also know from the Alex Betts study that I think in 2014 or 2015, 90% plus of the refugees in Kampala didn't need humanitarian aid because they were working. And so you've got a bargain there between local people and the refugees that they're able to work. Now, my learning from that is that there are some unique features of the Ugandan situation that explain their generosity towards their neighbors, largely to do with the fact that their neighbors were very generous towards them when they needed them. And so I think there's a very, you've got to make the argument to make it possible for a country like Jordan or a country like Bangladesh to really make a big outreach to give adult refugees the chance to work, they've got to get a massive macroeconomic boost because they are delivering on a global public good and they need the help of the World Bank and the IMF, not just humanitarian aid, to help them tie them over. And we need to think in radically more ambitious ways about 10-year, 20-year bargains with countries that are hosting large numbers of refugees to give them the macroeconomic support that allows them to say to their own people, look, it's not just the refugees who have a right to work. I mean, it would be a terrible situation if you think the refugee has a right to work, but no one else can get to work because of the economic situation. They're going to say to their own population, yes, we're going to give the refugees a chance to work because we want them to be productive in our society, but we're also going to use the international support we get to make sure that you, the residents of Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh, or you, the residents of Jordan, where there's a 26% unemployment rate, you're going to get chances to get into work as well.
We had Anne Richard on Displaced recently, who was the Assistant Secretary in State Department, and she made the really interesting point that when you talk about humanitarian policy, the focus tends to be on aid, giving money out, but actually you can make an even bigger difference through the diplomatic outreach you do to countries to try and persuade them to open up job markets to refugees. But that has to be backed up, as you say, with a bit more heft, with some leverage. Now, one of the examples, I mean, you touched on it just then, was Jordan, where there was a compact put together, which in theory looked really attractive. It offered incentives for firms. If they hire 20 or 25% of their workforce as refugees, they got lower trade barriers into the European Union. The government of Jordan got some concessional finance from the World Bank. It felt like everybody was incentivized to extend work permits, but it's not quite turned out quite as rosily as we'd have liked. And you were, you know, you met the King of Jordan when we were working very hard on this. And what's your reflection on whether the Jordan Compact is a model and what would need to be different for it to work?
Well, I think the aspirations of the Jordan Compact are a model. I mean, the aspiration was that Jordan will get a dividend, a boost, that will allow it to improve the situation of its own population and help 650,000 registered Syrian refugees and allegedly another 650,000 unregistered. It hasn't worked, I think, for a number of reasons. One, or it hasn't worked as it should. I mean, Jordan has extended 65,000 work permits. I think 30,000 people have actually got into, 30,000 refugees have got into work. I mean, you've taught me this. I mean, why hasn't it worked? One, because Jordan's debt to GDP ratio has still gone up to 94%, and the IMF program requires them to cut it to 77% by 2003. So there's an austerity program essentially in place. Secondly, the microeconomics of getting refugees into work has not been properly addressed. The refugees fear that they'll lose humanitarian benefits if they get into work. The employers don't know where to find them. Thirdly, the boost from the European Union was just not big enough because the free trade access agreement wasn't going to give them a big enough dividend if you're a Jordanian company to overcome what they perceived to be a lot of the bureaucracy associated with it. So I think the aspirations were right, and I think it would be very, very, it would be tragic to give up on it because Jordan is such a pivotal state. But it needs, I mean, there's a fiction in the Western diplomatic and donor world that the Syrian refugee crisis is short-term, not long-term. And that fiction is completely disabling. I mean, if you get yourself out of the mindset that the refugees are about to go home and get yourself into the mindset that they need to be able to contribute to the society they're living in, you're into a different conversation. And I think that hasn't really happened.
one of the obvious consequences of the Syrian crisis that we were just talking about has been the huge influx of refugees into Europe. Not half as many as went into Lebanon and Jordan, but obviously significant enough to affect the politics there. And I want to turn to that issue now. I mean, if you look at the voting figures on populist right-wing parties, in 2000, the voting share for populist right-wing parties was about 8%. Now they're at about 25%. And within striking
Europe,
yes, in Europe, and within striking distance of serious influence and power in many parts. And the sad thing is, the very values and institutions that are most needed to help refugees are now under threat, in some part because of the refugee crisis. I want to spend a bit of time delving into why we are seeing the rise of the authoritarian right across the world, but particularly in Europe, and the extent to which the migration and refugee crisis played a part into that. There have been lots of books covering this in recent in the last year that have been all lamenting the decline of democracy, such as Yasha Monk's People v. Democracy, David Runciman's How Democracy Ends, and a whole host of others. And I think a standard explanation that you could draw from across those is the following. The reason we have got a right-wing populist surge is firstly because of economic shocks, the stagnation in living standards over many, many years. And perhaps the most striking fact here is from Raj Chetty's work, who says that in for an American born in 1940, 9 out of 10 Americans ended up better off in real terms than their parents. 9 out of 10. Whereas parents, by 1980, that figure drops to just 5 out of 10. And I think that's a really interesting benchmark, more interesting than income deciles and so on. If you think that you are going to end up less well off than your parents at their same age, that feels like real downward mobility. And so I think there is a real issue about the economic change, particularly given that bankers were getting bailouts while the public were suffering from austerity. The second dimension is that that economic insecurity was then compounded by a set of social changes that left people feeling insecure, including in relation to migration. And one of the facts that I think is staggering is if you take the UK, in 2003, the UK had 1.2 million European Union migrants. By 2016, that figure had gone from 1.2 million to over 3 million. And it's not surprising because during that period, we basically did a big experiment with open borders with 27 countries. We enlarged the European Union and allowed open borders. And at the same time, while Europe was economically sick, Britain wasn't doing very well either, but it was doing slightly better than the rest of Europe because we weren't in the Eurozone. So we had this terrible moment where the economy was bad, but 2 million European migrants were coming in. It's little wonder then that you get some sort of backlash. And the thing is, I think that the third element is that politically, those mainstream parties were quite discredited. They may have lacked credibility with their local populations, and they weren't really responding to any of the issues with the radicalism needed. And that's left essentially the room open for populists to fill that vacuum. And you're seeing that everywhere in Europe and elsewhere. Now, that's a sort of synthesis of a lot of different explanations in the literature. What about that explanation do you buy, and what do you not?
Well, now you can see why I've employed Ravi Gurumurthy for the last 10 years. So, I basically agree with that. That's basically the answer. I mean, the explanation you've given, I think, is a good one. The combination of fast cultural change, stroke social change, economic squeeze, is a potent combination. The figure that comes to mind about the US, I think this is more or less true. In the 1950s, it took 300 hours of a minimum wage job to repay a higher education loan, and now it's 4,000 hours of a minimum wage job to repay a higher education loan. It's of that order of magnitude. And so the meaning of what it means to be in the middle class and to get into the middle class has been changed fundamentally. I think that the other element, which I do think is part of the story, is that you didn't really highlight the financial crisis enough, but the fact that the financial crisis came with big social change, not just when we talk about cultural change, we're not just talking about immigration, by the way. I mean, I think that the sort of revolution in life chances for women and how that's being played out at the moment in the US in a very stark form. But those social and cultural changes went at the same time as the what we thought was the democratization of political life through social media, through spread of mechanisms for people to organize, debate, shout individually and collectively, I think has really broken the political institutions. And so I feel at the moment that the traditional center-left and center-right are struggling to come up with answers, both on the above all on the economic questions. The political economy is the biggest deficit. I actually think on the immigration front, it's simple, really. The places that have the most immigrants are actually the most pleased to have them. It would be much worse the other way. Remember, if the big cities were that are diverse were actually the most resentful, then that would be a much more worrying situation. But you do have an issue where there's fast change, even if the absolute numbers aren't huge, where there's fast change in percentage terms in small towns across the Western world. And I think that is manageable at a policy level, but it becomes impossible when you haven't got an accommodating economic environment and when you are seeing your political institutions turned upside down by social media.
So one element of the explanation that I wrestle with is how important the economic dimension is. And the reason I think it's worth dwelling on is that if you look at some of the data on what young people in particular think, it's really, really fascinating. So Yasha Monk's work, drawing from the World Value Survey, shows that young people on high incomes are disproportionately likely to want army rule in the US. So 35%
army rule.
Army rule. So 35%. I mean, maybe right now that may not be a bad thing, but 35%. 35% of young people.
I think you better cut that from the final podcast.
35% of young people on high incomes want army rule, compared to 17% on average, which in itself is up from 6% in 1995. So everybody has got more in favour of.
That just shows that people have completely hacked off with politics. I mean, it doesn't. People think that the political system isn't delivering for them. It's not that they want to return to General Pinochet and martial rule.
Okay, well, let me put it another way. Okay, one other question relates to this, which is why is it that the populists of the right have benefited from this crisis rather than the populists of the left? If it was all about a crisis of capitalism, why has there not been a left-wing populist surge?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that, obviously, I don't know the answer to that, but my speculation would be the thesis would be there was the most massive market failure in 2008, so why didn't pro-market parties get the blame rather than not? Now, I think that if I was in government at the time, and there's no question in my mind that we failed to prosecute the argument, perhaps because we were in power. It became a government failure, not a market failure. And that's why, in crude terms, this has been adduced to the benefit of the left or the center-left. I think that it's very striking to be living in America. You know, the Tea Party movement has become a very significant part of right of center politics in America. The Occupy Wall Street movement has not become a significant part of, or certainly not on the same scale, on the part of left of center politics. So my explanation would be that in the eyes of a lot of the population, government got the blame because it didn't do its job of regulating financial markets effectively.
I think that's totally true. I think the other thing that resonates from that era is that austerity meant that there was no money. And so people used to say, what do social democrats do when there's no money?
Yeah, but remember in America, they did you could argue that it should have been a bigger Keynesian boost in the after the 2008 election. But they didn't fall into the austerity trap in the US, and that's why they had better economic results.
But do you think, though, that if there wasn't the shadow of immigration hanging over Europe and America in the last decade, do you think it's possible that left-wing populists might have done better?
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I don't think one should. I think it would be mad to be complacent or underestimate the impact of immigration. But I think it's also important if you look at the data that I remember from the UK. has shown some waxing and waning in whether or not immigration is the top issue, and for whom is it the top issue. And so I think it's impossible to say, but the truth is that we've got to win the argument that management of immigration, in the same way as management of labour markets, is a core function of government. We should have had what were called transitional controls in after 2004.
We being the UK.
The UK, when we were in government in the UK, all but two European countries said that when the eight Central and Eastern European countries entered the European Union, that there would be transitional controls on the number of workers who could move. That would have been a managed markets approach to that.
Why did we not do that, by the way?
Because we thought, stupidly it turned out, that 50,000 Poles would come, and in fact 500,000 Poles came. Now, we know, the data shows very clearly that those Poles are less likely to be unemployed than the rest of the native population. They are more likely to be taxpayers, and they've been very productive citizens. Having said that, to my point that in small-town Britain or medium-sized town Britain, you can have quite big rupture in respect of social and public services, in respect of housing, has created a real backlash. And so I think that we shouldn't fall for the lie that somehow people have come to enjoy British welfare or British health services. They've come to better themselves and contribute to the economy. But contributing to the economy is not enough.
You mentioned managed migration before. To what extent do you feel that we actually have to be quite tough on migration in order to preserve room for allowing refugees in? So to put it another way, is the only way in which we can win the argument on maintaining open borders to refugees that we actually make some sort of distinction between deserving and less deserving migrants?
Well, I wouldn't put it like that, but I think that... In my own mind, the baker who's bombed from their house in Damascus, or the girl who's driven from her school in northeast Nigeria, has a different moral as well as legal claim from someone, to take the example of Poland, from someone who wants to go from Poland to Germany to work. There's a different moral claim, and I don't think we should shun that. I think, secondly, it's really important not to fall for the argument that somehow it's tough for a country to know who's coming in the borders and who's not, and who's leaving. And one of the things I reflect on in the US debate is that refugees have paid the price of the unfinished debate about the 11 million so-called undocumented immigrants into America. The fact that America hasn't had an immigration act since 1986 is part of the reason that the demonization of refugees was possible, because they got lumped in with, I mean, the 90,000 average, which is the number of refugees who've traditionally come to the US, got lumped in with the alleged 11 million undocumented who'd arrived here through other means. So I don't think it's about being tough or not, but I think it's about being, about recognizing that it's totally legitimate for a country to decide on its immigration policy according to its social and economic circumstances. But if it's a signatory to the UN Convention on Refugees, it's not legitimate for a country to say it's not willing to take refugees and give them the rights that they deserve.
So the final thing that I wrestle with on this whole explanation of why authoritarianism is on the rise is... What would have happened if we had...
Well, you said populism can be on the rise. That's different from authoritarianism being on the rise.
Well, that's a good question, because, would you class Macron as a populist? In some ways he was, because he ran against the establishment. Would you class Jeremy Corbyn as a populist?
Well, there's a difference between being popular and being populist, and Macron had the gift of being popular. Without wishing to do a political science seminar about it, I mean, the best definition of populist is someone who is anti-pluralist. And if you read the literature on this, I think that's a good way of understanding it. That leads to authoritarian tendencies. I think if you define it in that way, calling Macron a populist doesn't make sense. He's sadly less popular than he was, so exactly. hopefully his popularity increases without him becoming a populist.
That's really an interesting distinction. I think the only way in which I was thinking he was a populist was the way in which he ran against the establishment and the incumbent parties. But I just want to get onto this final point, which is, do you think that we need a radical change in our politics, both how we distribute power, how our politicians act, or more, do you think that if we just had some really, really good political leaders, if a Bill Clinton, a Barack Obama, a Tony Blair, even a David Miliband were around now...
Now you're really tempting me.
Do you think it's winnable? Because you could very well see the argument being that we don't need these big structural changes. We've just got some really good leaders who are able to build the coalitions that existed before.
I mean, I've learned in America that when people say that's a great question, that basically means they don't know the answer. So... That's a great question. Look, I think there are more structural things going on. I'm not a great believer in the great man theory's history. It's evidently true that it's much better to have talented politicians than untalented politicians. It's striking that social democrats across Europe, which is the area I know best, I suppose, are doing almost uniformly badly. There's a fragmentation of politics that speaks to some structural trends that are going on. And I do come back to the fact that the historic task of social democracy has been to regulate markets and actually save capitalism from itself, to make it work for the many, not the few, so quote unquote. And what we face today, though, is a slightly different challenge, which is that social democrats, and the camp I put myself in, we have a job to manage markets because markets are out of control in various ways and they abuse people when they are. But we also have a job to do, which is to defend the most basic liberal democratic norms that became the common sense of the age after the Second World War. And an age in which those norms are breached, whether for citizens in their own country seeking access to the law or for refugees trying to get there to exercise their rights, I think is a really serious issue. And I am worried about populism when it, if you understand that to be the assault on pluralism, because that's what leads to governments packing their courts with judges, is what, and I'm thinking of the Eastern European cases at the moment, it's what leads to governments to suspend the constitutions because they have two-thirds of the members of parliament, which happened in Hungary. So that march of genuine authoritarianism, the undermining of liberal democratic not just mores but rights, I think is a really historic challenge for the centre-left and the centre-right to come together on. Now, here's the difficulty that I see. If you accept that argument that centre-right and centre-left have to come together to defend the essence of what makes liberal democracies liberal and democratic, then the danger is that it looks like they're in bed together and the people who are challenging them are the far-right or the far-left. And so the trick that has to be pulled off is for centre-right and centre-left to be competing across a range of social and economic questions while sustaining the defence of liberal democratic norms. And I thought there was something very significant that happened in the European Parliament 2 weeks ago, which is that centre-right and centre-left, and it's more remarkable in a way that the centre-right did this, both condemned the Hungarian assault on democracy in Hungary and sent out a very clear warning that the rules of the European club meant that you weren't going to get the European subsidies and investments if you didn't adhere to the political rules of the European Union. And I think that's really, really important.
And in places where, like the UK, where you really feel like there is a vacuum in the centre, both the centre-right, arguably, and the centre-left, do you think it's basically inevitable that that vacuum will be filled, for instance, with a new party? Or do you think it's possible that it can be sustained with this?
Well, I mean, nothing's inevitable. That's the biggest lesson of modern politics, that anything can happen. I mean, you only have to look around the world to see that. I think that I don't believe that the bell curve of political attitudes has suddenly become two hills in which the extreme right and the extreme left are suddenly where most people locate themselves. I do think that it's important to recognize that extremes in economics will produce extremes in politics unless they are addressed, and that we have extremes in economics now that are not being addressed, and that is the wellspring of radicalism, which can be positive, but also populism, which can be very dangerous.
So a lot of the writers on democracy have sometimes referred to democracy having a midlife crisis. And I don't want to sort of do another podcast where I talk about somebody being old, but
thank
David,
you.
As you age,
yes.
You're somebody who I think is fantastically restless for change. You always want to make a difference in every day that you do your job. How do you think about making a difference today, given the incredibly dramatic events in the world? What is your calling now?
Well, my calling is obviously to do my job to the best of my ability. But I thought what you were going to ask is, how do you make change? And
that's my next question.
Yeah, okay, so how you make change? I think that what's really... I just come from an event with Al Gore, actually, just to drop a name. And I was interviewing
Al
him.
Al who?
And he's done something remarkable, and I didn't get a chance to ask him this question, but I was asking him other questions. But what he's doing with his work on climate is remarkable. I don't know how many people know this. It's not just that he is the truth teller of the inconvenient truth of the climate crisis and why it needs to be addressed. He's created this climate reality project where 2 million people around the world have been trained as climate activists. And what that made me think is that really... big change happens when three things are lined up. One, government leadership. Two, business or organizational innovation. So it could be an NGO. And three, mass mobilization. And evidently what's happening in, certainly in the US at the moment on the climate crisis, is there's a retreat from government. So the other two layers, the business innovation and the mass mobilization, have to push forward. But my theory of the case about how you make change is that you get those three things lined up. And it's not always that government leads and then business follows and then people mobilize. Sometimes you have to do it in the other direction. Sometimes the mobilization has to come first, then the businesses follow, and then the government comes at the end. But that's, if I think about all the biggest changes that I've been involved with, whether in schools or in the environment, or in politics itself, it's when you line up those three factors where there's the responsibility of government, the responsibility of institutions in business or in civil society, and the responsibility of individuals are clear. And that's, I think, the golden thread that we should all be trying to push forward on, whether our calling is in respect of climate or is in respect of displaced people.
And for people here who are sort of frustrated by what they're seeing on the news, what advice have you got?
Well, I'm one of them.
You're one of them. I think we all of us wrestle with the question of, how do you make a difference? How do you resist? How far to go? And what does smart resistance look like? And what are your reflections on that?
Well, smart resistance doesn't give ammunition to the other side. Smart resistance builds coalition to beat the other side. And I think that's a really important thing to hold in mind. I think the requirement to think differently about how you exercise political power. If government is out of bounds, how do businesses feel the pressure from their employees, from their shareholders, to live out social and economic principles that are important for the sustainability of the planet? How do people mobilize? And I think that you've got to be pushing the boundaries as far within legal limits as far as possible in that. And the resources to do that are actually greater than ever before, which is why politics broadly defined is still exciting.
David Miliband, thank you so much for being with us on Displaced.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. Our production team at Vox Media includes associate producer Jelani Carter and senior producer Golda Arthur.
Did you know she likes death metal? That's all she listens to.
At Vox Media, Nishat Kerwa is executive producer of audio.
And at the IRC, a huge thank you to Alex Bandea, Ben Moskowitz, and Catherine Long. We will see you next week.